With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Your lonely souls. God knows your lonely souls.
So tell me about steaming first up. If I had the money, I would get a little steam room in my house. I know the accessibility of that is never likely to come true, no, but like, what are the mental and physical benefits that you found from doing it?
It's just one. It's a routine that I have every day where it's just...
Every day?
Pretty much, yeah, just to clear the cobwebs.
And then does that get you set up for work, or do you have another ritual before you then
settle
into...
No, that's my sort of general... Well, I like it to be my morning ritual, but it tends to be, so I can set up the day. So I go for I have a steam and a swim and, you know, clear my head and then start. But it's also the wonders of when you smoke and stuff that... It helps clean you out.
I'm on day 6 of trying to give up for the 100th time.
Yeah.
Have you ever managed to quit for any extended period?
I tried earlier this year, and I tried to do a dry January and give up smoking.
Well, I find the two have to go hand in hand for me, because I can go, say, a week or two without a smoke, but then the second alcohol hits my lips.
Terrible. I tried, but it was like literally going completely cold turkey, and it just slightly backfired.
So you still enjoy a drink, and you're at a healthy point with that? With alcohol, you've got a nice, healthy relationship.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't really drink. I sort of don't have a major palate of what I drink anymore, because the sort of days of drinking spirits, DJing, and touring are sort of over, really. So I like a glass of Prosecco.
Nice.
But that's probably more the fact that I like sugar.
Yes. Well, I've found that sugar's my new vice at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's just endless, though. The vices are just endless, you know.
And well, once one is gone, it's usually replaced with another, isn't it?
I mean, I think diet-wise, pretty good. I have a pretty, you know, generally quite a plant-based diet, but I do like a bit of meat, but not particularly heavy on that front, you know. And a lot of wheat has gone in the last, you know, over the last sort of 10 years.
Yeah, that's some of the worst stuff, isn't it?
Well, I had to stop. I stopped drinking beer because of wheat originally, and that sort of then became quite a thing of lots of other alcoholic things. But also just, you know, I don't really eat. You know, it's funny when you think about, you know, here we're generally such a wheat-based society, but sandwiches, you know, I never have a sandwich at lunch, or, you know, I very rarely sort of have a pizza or something like that. Anyway, there's my, you know, but I'm, you know, I'm sort of pretty, I sort of like to have a balanced thing. I'm not too extreme.
Everything in moderation, yeah, as they say, right?
Well, I'm not too extreme. I'm extreme with lots of other things, but...
Not what you're putting in your body.
The wonderful sort of, not the slightly, well, I suppose for me that the nocturnal side of my life is very different now. You know, I spent, you know, 20 years hardcore DJing in clubs, and that just got later and later and later and later. And, you know, you'd start on a Friday and you'd finish on a Wednesday, that kind of lifestyle. And those days are slightly over now.
It's a hardcore way to make a living. I'm nothing at like your level, but I do DJ a lot. I was DJing last night till 2. And it's just a very different existence to what you might call the normal, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for people, unless they've been in that pattern, to really understand how isolating it can be as well. Although
it's very, very isolating. It was, I think, a lot, you know, it consumed me with anxiety, you know, for a long time, which affected many other things that I did in my life. I think it's, you know, DJing is one of the greatest sort of, or performing, whether, you know, you're in in any sort of performing way, the adrenaline and experience can be incredible. But, you know, if you're usually, you know, unless you're in the sort of club world, most of the other performance worlds are pretty, you know, you're finished at a reasonable time. Even if you're generally in a band, unless you're playing festivals, you're generally finished by 11 o'clock.
Well, the other thing with bands as well is they have bandmates.
Yeah, and you
and
have
you
a lot
have
of people around
to share
you, and you have
the ride with.
Yeah, and you have your crew and da 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 da. But, you know, from the age of 15 to sort of my early 30s, I was pretty much on my own most of the time traveling. And whilst it was wonderful in so many ways to experience the world and meet people, it also was every night you're meeting somebody new, and that can be, you know, it can it's a strange way of living. I think the way, you know, I think things also, you know, at the height of when I was playing, it was a very hedonistic time. You know, it wasn't a social media period.
Of course, you're off grid.
Photograph, you're off grid. And it was, you know, it was part of the sort of, you know, a lot of it was part of the experience. But I think now, because DJing has become such a massive economic boom, you know, you don't have a Forbes band list. You have a Forbes DJ list. You know, when you look at somebody like, I don't know, the stats that I looked at last year where Calvin Harris made, I think last year alone, 50 million. The year before he made 190.
Aoki and people like that.
Aoki, I think, did about 35 million. Stiplo, 20 or 30. Tiesto, 30. I mean, you're talking about a very different...
And there's no overheads with that, is there?
Not in the context. I think that's why DJing has exploded in...
Do you need to get the door?
Yeah.
Yeah, no worries. Take a pause there. I keep all this stuff in anyway, James. Yeah. I like the looseness... No worries,
mate. Just doing something in here for... No, it's cool. Just come and grab whatever. So I totally forgot. Come in.
Hiya.
Solo, come here. Come on. Sorry, just 1 second.
No worries, mate. See, most dogs take a little twig. She's got like the full...
He's just like...
the log.
He's just his way of showing off.
Is this your first dog, James?
Not. I had a dog when I was a kid. My father's had dogs for years, but my first dog is an adult.
I really want one. I haven't got quite the right lifestyle for one just yet.
It is amazing.
Because it's a full-time job, isn't it?
I wouldn't be able to do it if it wasn't for my partner.
Yeah.
She's really very, very routine and very good. Thanks. Is that all right? Sorry about that. I'll see you in a minute. All right. Cheers. I think you know, it's interesting with the rise of DJing because it's that American thing that's kind of smashed it. You know, and it's that typical way that once America gets into things, they sort of take it to another level. It's always bigger, louder, you know, you know, more pizzazz and everything. But I suppose with Vegas, if you sort of think about Vegas now, which is this sort of DJ metropolis, you know, if you do Cirque du Soleil, I suppose you've got to put 350 million quid into investing into building the thing in the first place. You've got to pay insurance and you've got whatever as a cast of 150 people.
Yep.
One DJ, you know, do the math. It's pretty mad. But it has changed. It's changed, I think. I think social media, I think just when anything becomes that much bigger and much more commercial, the you know, it becomes more under the spotlight in certain ways. I think, you know, so I think a lot of the DJ culture has changed. And also I think that a lot of, you know, there's a huge rise of young DJs that have now, who are really sort of, you know, taken over from, you know, the generation, when I was younger, that the generation were a bit older than me, they kind of ran it for a very long time.
Yeah, it was like a closed door almost, wasn't it? Like a private members club.
Yeah, and you know, whether it was the Carl Coxes or the Pete Tongs or whatever, and it was very Anglophiled for a long time. And I think with the shift, it's now become, there's a whole new generation, much younger, it's much more multicultural, and it's much more mixed in the sense that the rise of female DJs as well. But I also think with that, a lot of that generation, the hedonism isn't part of, this is not so part of the thing.
Or even the musicology element, perhaps.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's a disservice, but I feel like back in the day, it was a lot more about you're chasing down that rare record that no one else has got.
I think it's changed but I think the parameters of what generally DJing is has changed dramatically. So most of the biggest DJs that have come out in the last 10 years, decade, are all producers.
Yeah, remixers and producers.
Mainly producers or artists, you know. And so the DJ sets are basically more based around their work.
Yep.
I think for me, that wasn't the case back in the day. It was the DJ was sort of, most DJs didn't actually make music a lot of the time, you know.
Because the technology wasn't really there as
well.
Well,
I just think, you know, it was, you had the artist and you had the DJ. You know, I think in a lot of, if you go back to the landscape of a lot of creativity and especially the record industry and things, you just had a different kind of, there were different parameters, there were different things that people did. You know, record companies would have, you know, an A&R department, a video department, a design department, da-da-da, you know, it all, you know, and there was a sort of, there was a whole kind of, what's the right word, kind of different structure to how things were done. And I think with DJing, you know, DJs tended to be very heavy musicologists, you know. So whether that would be, as an example, a Norman Jay or a Giles Peterson or a DJ Harvey or a, you know, Francois Kevorkian or, you know, as examples, you know, they tended to be generally just very much about, you know, it was very much based around the records they played and their ability to discover and break records. And I think now it's changed that most of, a lot, not of course not all in any account, but a lot of what's happened in the change in DJ culture is that a lot, it's very producer led, you know. And so you'll go and see, you know, it's more like John Hopkins DJing, or, which I'm not as an example, you know, I think he's amazing, but, you know,
Different.
It's just different, yeah. You know. But I also think that the landscape of, you know, there's a lot of, you know, for a lot of people, there's a lot of money involved. So equally, I think, but there's also a lot of pressure. So I think one of the things that wasn't really, you know, when I started DJing was at the thick of it, you know, you weren't talking about anxiety. You weren't talking about, you know, addiction. You weren't.
It was partying and coming down.
Yeah. And it was very hard. Yeah. And it was also a very laddie, male driven sort of, but quite, you know, predominantly most of the big DJs first came out of football in the UK. So it was a kind
and
of
the culture that comes with that.
Yeah. So it was laddie, you know, and so when you were slightly alternative, like I was, it was quite a weird place to be, you know. I mean, as an example, I remember being, there was a magazine called Music Magazine, which was sort of blew up in the 90s as the big new music, you know, DJ culture magazine, which had a, you know, which, and they had in the back, they had a back page called Hang the DJ. So if a DJ had done something, whatever, played a shit record, or, you know, I got hung because I dyed my hair. You know, now if people don't, you know, if people haven't got a tattoo or haven't got dyed hair or whatever, it doesn't look, you know, it's gone completely the other way. But I also think that it's also, you know, people are a lot more, you know, going back to what we were talking about when we first started talking, I think people are a lot more conscious of their health.
Yeah.
And if you're
young
gonna
kids
do
aren't really going
150
out to the park
gigs
and drinking cider,
a year, 150 gigs a year, and you want to also make records and as many, you know, you look at somebody like Peggy Goo. I mean, you know, she's like now she's the model for Nike. She's getting a clothing company with the people that did Off-White. She's playing 150 gigs a year. She's running a, you know, major Instagram account. You know, da 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 da. As an example, I don't know how you can manage all that when you're
on a hangover.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
A lot of it's changed, and I think, but also just the fact that, you know, everybody's so conscious of their appearance and what you know, the environment being, you know, because everybody's capturing it constantly. So, I think there's a lot of positives from that, but I also feel like, you know, like anything, and I don't want to sound sort of going backwards, but I think, you know, the glory days of when things were just that sort of period of the lunatics running the asylum, I think that's kind of slightly over, you know.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah,
even
yeah.
though you, there are places that you go where it's still got that amazing freedom, and just culturally people are not so in your face. You know, let's say if you're in Berlin, or I was in Tel Aviv recently. You know, it's very kind of like, it's got that feeling of, you know, 20 years ago. People aren't, there aren't cameras everywhere. There's just a different kind of energy, you know, and it's very late and it's very sort of
loose. Yeah.
But, you know, people are also equally, when you're in Europe or a lot, you know, or South America or somewhere like, you know, Tel Aviv, whatever, people are also, you know, it's culturally not a sort of binge culture. So you don't see that kind of, it's not as sort of, you know, messy. It never has been, you know.
That's a very British thing, isn't it? Very British. You see it when you're abroad, say, travelling with a partner on your own, and you run into a group of Brits.
Yeah.
I had it recently in Bruges in Belgium, and I was like, Jesus, is that what we're like?
Yeah, no, it's fucking awful. I try and avoid it. Like, well, it's not. It's a certain kind of British mentality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not my thing. And I think for me, you know, there was a whole thing of when I started and everything, you know, most of my career, I've always sort of been slightly out of the box. I've never really, you know, I wasn't the lad part of the football lot and that side of it. I wasn't street enough and hip hop enough and gangster enough. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't old enough. And I think part of what I did is I just thrust myself. So I, you know, it became quite competitive. There was a very competitive atmosphere constantly within the music business when I started. I'm sure it still exists now, but it was very, very hardcore.
And you specifically were, you know, from watching the Man with Moax documentary, you were a hustler from a very young age.
Yeah.
And obviously very driven.
Yeah.
Where do you think that came from?
I don't really know, to be honest with you. I mean, I it's weird because I see the film and I look back and it's a person that I don't really know in the same way anymore. And I just had a certain kind of drive, and I think there was a naive, you know, I was really prepared to throw myself into the deep end on all accounts. And some of that was incredibly progressive and beneficial, and some of that was incredibly detrimental to me, you know.
So fear wasn't really an emotion back then, right?
It was, of course. But I seemed to be quite navigate. I don't know if it's the Irish in me, but I was quite good at navigating through that. And I've always been able to sort of, I've had incredibly difficult ups and downs, and I suffer a lot from depression.
Was that always the case? Did you feel like out of step as a kid?
It has been, yeah, since I was a child, yeah. And so I've seemed to have some kind of quite weird wall that I've managed to put up. I don't know if that's from starting from so young, you know, when you're so young, when you're thrust into things, it's sort of maybe what's normal to other people isn't normal to you. And in many ways, I'm finding that's part of when you know, I think what happens, and we're dealing with a lot of it right now with so many young people, with so many problems, you know, and
well, the pressure's on young people now as well, man, prevalent. With Facebook and social media and everything, and trying to present this perfect life.
Yeah.
It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think we grew up in the last age where young kids were actually really free from that. Obviously, there's always pressure and kids always are sort of mean, and that's always been around. But I think the internet and social media has really accelerated.
Oh, yeah. No, it's, I think I don't quite, I wouldn't, you know, you think about if you were, when you, you know, inevitably at some point being bullied at school, and that was probably, you know, about six people that would be on your case.
Yeah. But then the you get home now, and you can escape it, can't you?
Whereas now, I mean, if that silly image of, you know, somebody's caught you in the wrong moment, the wrong time, you know, somebody's taking the piss out of you because you're, I don't know, for example, naked in the shower back in the day, it was only a few people are going to see that. If somebody now takes that picture and posts it, then suddenly, you know, or you hear these, you know, horrible things of, you know, people, you know, kids having sex or whatever, and the guys or the girls posted something. I mean, it's like that, and everybody can see. I think that's pretty, would be very, I can't imagine.
That devastating.
I mean, I deal with it because I have a 21-year-old daughter. So there are a lot of those issues that we have to talk about a lot, and things that, you know, affect her from social media, etc., as I think most young people do. But I think for me, I being young, I sort of developed this sort of kind of wall, and the drive is always, I'm still always driven to try and see whatever it is through, you know,
against all odds,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah. And I'm not sure what, where, you know, where it's come from. I mean, you know, at times I sort of look back and think, why the fuck did you do that? You know, what, why? Or, you know, and a lot of back in the day was, I think, just maybe having more time, you know, where, you know, when you're young, you don't really think about time. But that's also why we're sitting here. And that's part of why there's, you know, the records and what has been made for good or bad has happened. And, you know, but I don't know, it's strange, especially looking back at MoWax. I mean, the film, it's like...
Did you have much involvement in the making of that?
I did and I didn't, you know. I did in the sense that probably about 90% of the footage is mine. It was instigated by me with my ex-wife when it started. And... And, you know, it's sort of, you know what's weird about it? I think in the back of my head, I never thought it was going to be finished. So it just kind of rolled along and along. And after 10 years of meetings and discussions that this documentary is going to come out, or let's do another bit more filming, or da, 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 you kind of just think, never going to come out. And then you're faced with this moment where it is and how you navigate that. And I think that there was a point for me, whether it was either, it's going to come out in one way or shape or form or another, which I kind of don't have control over. And you know, that was a point where I didn't really feel the film was as good as it could. I didn't think it was engaging. It was a rough cut that I was shown a few years ago. And then I kind of gave Matt and Mac a huge load of boxes of old VHS and DVD that I'd shot over the years, which then became most of the film. And that was a bit like Pandora's box, because I didn't look at the footage, because there was 800 hours of it.
800 hours,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, and I didn't go through it, which I would recommend that if you do something like this in the future, maybe go through your 800 hours of footage. But I think that there was also just when I saw the sort of, in the end, what it was really going to be, there was a moment of sort of, fuck, okay, do I want to do this? You know, I think for anybody to see them, well, it depends how narcissistic you are, but I think for most people to see yourself in any way on camera or on film in that way, it's weird. You know, it's a very strange thing. And one has to keep reminding oneself that one's not dead as well, because, you know, it's sort of, you know, a lot of documentaries like that are kind of, you know,
posthumous.
You know, but equally, I thought from, you know, I have a filter system around me. I think it's important that you have people around you that you trust, and I don't employ generally people just to be yes people. You know, I don't have that. I'm fortunate that I work with a lot of people that I really value their opinions.
And they challenge you.
And they challenge things at times. And, you know, the consensus within my community of, you know, those that I work with and love their opinions was, I think this is important to do it as it is and not, you know. And I felt myself that, you know, there is a narrative, there is a story that's being told. It's not entirely exactly how, you know, to show my life over 30 years, it would be 30 years of footage. So you can't see everything. And it had a kind of narrative that it wanted, a story it wanted to tell, because it wasn't made by myself. And I wrestled with some of the narrative because, as an example, you know, if you've got Giles Peterson talking about war stories, to me, it wasn't a record that was made for Giles Peterson. So there is a narrative within the film that sort of come. It's very much based around a relationship with DJ Shadow.
Yeah.
And those were from that period of time, because the filmmaker, that's his glory vision of my career and how to get back to that. But in many ways, I've been trying to get away from that, you know, for the last 20 years.
And so it is kind of the central thread,
you know,
in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. And but when somebody's talking, you know, when somebody, like, if you had Trent Reznor talking about war stories, that would make sense, because, you know, War Stories was a record, as an example, that was not made for Straight No Chaser or Giles, not because anything against them, but it was a record that was made in the West Coast of America with Chris Goss and Queens of the Stone Age, and, you know, and was, you know, and became a record that really engaged with that. I wanted to move things into a different world and explore different things. And I think, you know, and that record became really well received within that world. I remember getting a letter from, you know, an email or whatever from Trent saying it's my favorite record of the year. So, but I suppose also there's an element that you can't have, you know, within a film, you know, the idea is that it's not just everybody saying how great you are, or,
yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
there
yeah.
has to be, you know, I think you also just need to show a human side. And for me, you know, my fears were that it was going to be that people would take what I felt negatively, and that would be what people would really focus on. So what I felt was my failures, which I feel quite a lot of failures in that respect.
And it's very honest in that regard, you know, isn't it?
But also, you know, your sometimes your, you know, nocturnal behavior, whatever, all those things, you know, how people were going to judge that and your and what you've done in your career. And actually what was interesting is that generally people reacted completely the opposite to what I thought, which was that people really felt that it was a very, you know, a lot of younger kids that have come up to me and talked to me, I think just amazed about the experience as a whole, because I think what we've just been talking about doesn't exist anymore, because this is pre social media, the beginning of it, and what is probably one of the most fascinating parts of the film is a whole period where there is no cameras in clubs. The reason that there is so little footage and why the 90s period of that film to me is so important and great, take me out of the equation, but all the other footage, is the fact that you didn't let cameras come in a studio, into a club. It was like, cheesy, man. What, a guy with a big lighting rig and a fucking massive camera filming you when you were DJing, or photographs when you're playing? It was like, that wasn't cool. Now, bands got photographed because they're on stage, you know, and there's big light, you know, but clubs were dark predominantly, and, you know, and you wanted to keep that feeling. So to see this kind of footage that was, you know, found and collated was, I thought that's pretty amazing. So I think for a certain generation, they're seeing something in the same way that when probably you and I, when I look at a Clash documentary, or, you know, even, you know, I mean, you can go back Led Zeppelin, whatever, you're like, oh my God, look how amazing, or, you know, I wish it was like that when we were doing it. I think there's a little bit of that. I think there's an honesty. I mean, I got a really great Instagram message the other day from one of, you know, she's one of the most powerful DJ managers in the world. You know, she manages Swedish House Mafia, and, you know, she kind of created the whole new wave of what we now call EDM. And whether you like that or not, it's pretty, what she did was pretty amazing. And so, and just getting this Instagram just saying, I've just seen my life. This is the most incredible thing. Thank you for being so honest. You know, I just want to say this is just so brave, and, you know, da da da. And I, you know, or, you know, I got the same kind of message from something like, I got it from, you know, the other day from Special Request. And, you know, so they're people that have, you know, from my generation that have lived through it, and then younger people. So I think
it's a story that's not really been told either, yeah, is it, before, yeah, in the documentary way before. So I, yeah, can imagine a lot of your peers would be like, oh wow, finally.
And I think also because we are now, I think, you know what, I think if it had come out 4 or 5 years ago, it could have been cool, I don't know if it would have had the same effect, because what you are seeing, there is a generation shift, there are people that are dying, there are people that are, you know, there's huge issues with mental health, anxiety, addiction, you know, we're questioning all manner of sexuality, all of these things. And I think so that, you know, I think it felt to me, actually, I was kind of like, you know, when it came out, I was like, wow, actually, this is probably the right time for this story to be told. Whereas maybe if this came out a decade ago, I don't know if that story would have been seen in the same way, because those questions, you know, it wasn't part, you know, culturally, I think we're much more sympathetic to the experience. You know, it's not like man up. It's like, oh my God. You know, for me, what you've got to understand is you're seeing a child. I was a child when I started. You know, you've got to remember that MOAC's finished when I was 28 years old, you know, and you're seeing, you know, that experience. And unfortunately, the cliches of being part of a very, you know, a very colorful, but can be very dark industry at times, you know, and something where you get eaten up and you get spat out and,
often,
you know,
by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, and then the snowball effect after that of actually, when you're young and you have great success, what tends to happen is that you don't do all the other things that everybody else does. So you don't go through, you know, you don't have much time to grow. You lose your childhood. You know, you don't, you've got loads of money when none of your mates do. So you're either then supporting them or you're alienated from that environment. You know, you're kind of, it's like Benjamin Button, everything's backwards, you know. So when everybody's 30 and they're starting to get their shit together and their careers and da da da, and they're having maybe about, you know, starting to think about having a family and da da da, you're already fucking had a, you know, you, everything's already happened. You've already got divorced. You've already done your money. You're already.
How old were you when you became a father?
I was 23.
Wow. So that's young as well, isn't it?
So, you know, pretty much as science fiction was happening. So that was added in that mix was very complicated. And believe me, you know, my daughter is the most amazingly important thing in my life. But it was a difficult thing to juggle the career that I had, not, you know, as a DJ, as an artist, as running a label, as being a father, you know, all of those things all at the same time. Mm. You know, whereas most people's lives are quite spread out. And then what happens is you get to sort of, you know, your 30s, you've kind of, and you're, it's a snowball, and you realise, I don't know how to drive. I don't know how to, I don't even know what my bank account is. I don't know, you know, all of the things that are kind of normal to people. Oh, how do you turn on a fucking washing machine? I don't know. You know, and it sounds silly, and but it's actually really debilitating, you know, which is what, you know, for me, what I think is so important to, you know, with kids and to give kids time. But also what's important now is you really need to just learn the basics so that you can handle, you know, to have, to know sort of life skills before you're thrust into some media spotlight. I mean, I feel for, like, you know, you look at sort of Justin Bieber at the moment, you look at Selena Gomez, I think she spent more time in rehab than she spent doing, making records or going. I mean, it's like, it's not healthy, you know, and you can have all the money in the world, but it becomes very destructive. And I don't think that in the end, the irony is it doesn't make you happy because you're completely alienated. You know, and I'm not, I was never on that level, that extreme, but I didn't have social media, you know, so I don't know what it would have been like being what I was then with social media. That would have been an interesting mix. Maybe I would have been more conscious of decisions because that was right in your face, or maybe you would have just been like so many other people are at the moment, where you're sort of living this extraordinary dream, but it's very out of kilter with everything, because now it's so extreme. You know, success is, you know, when I'm making a couple of hundred grand in the 90s, okay, it was like making maybe £1 million. These, you know, now, you know, people are making tens of millions, hundreds of millions. You know?
Regular people as well, people who just have reality a YouTube page.
I mean, well, look at the Kardashians. I mean, it's extraordinary that a 21-year-old girl is worth $1 billion.
With no discernible talent.
I don't mean that negatively, that a 21-year-old girl should not have $1 billion. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At all. But in the sense of what
it is bonkers.
But it's bonkers in also in the context of what it's come from and everything. It's mad, you know.
And the sort of installation that it has on the youth as well.
Well, then, like, Kardashian. So then the problem is that all these kids don't think they can achieve because the bar, you know, the bar for me was, you know, my bar was first would
what
be,
was your goal when you well, started when I out started, going to the clubs, you know, knocking on be, doors to get DJ sets?
Well, first it'd just be to get a, you know, work in a record store and be able to play a record in a club. Just do anything to be able to play in a club, you know, or in a sound system or whatever. Just be able to play a record to people. You know, then it would be, you know, to get certain people to come and buy records in your shop, you know, to build relationships, just anything to try and build a relationship. So, oh my God, you know, when I was in Bluebird, I'd be like, oh my God, Pete Tong's coming, or Paul Oakenfold, like, you know, can I, you know, anything to be able to, that, you know, that was the barometer. You know, then the barometer would be, to get a residency. Then the barometer would be to basically start putting some kind of, you know, have a label or go and work for a record company. You have a label, like I did with Moax. The most important thing, one of the most important things ever for me was getting Giles Peterson to play my first record on radio. That was all that mattered. That was it. And I'm 18.
So it was a very organic, gradual.
Yeah. And obviously those then start building. And then you sell, you know, and then you sell 10,000 records and you're like, oh God, wouldn't it be great to sell da 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 da? And then, you know, and then that's when it was, and then you suddenly start a million records and da da da, and you've got the deal and da da da, and it's like, the barometer changed. But it was, you know, there was a sort of, a lot of it was very organic, and a lot of it wasn't this sort of thing of worldwide takeover and sort of, you know, it was, it was very community-based in the sense that it really, you know, I remember we'd always laugh. It's like, we didn't give a, no disrespect, but you didn't care about getting in the enemy. You didn't care about, you didn't care about any of that stuff. You didn't care about Radio 1 or the enemy. You cared about the because I'm coming from a more dance music background. So, you know, is that all you cared about was the things, the you know, was the DJs that were playing your records or the magazines that, you know, it was The Face or ID or, you know, or Blues and Soul or whatever. But you know, it was kind of very much culturally based on your environment, you know, and so there was kind of a ladder of steps that you took. I think now you have this thing where there isn't much of a ladder. I mean, look back at some of our greatest performers in the UK ever. You know, you look at, you know, David Bowie, you look at Elton John, you look at Queen. You know, they didn't happen in 5 minutes.
No.
Kate Bush didn't happen after 3 records. Bowie, I don't think, happened till about 5. And I don't think Elton John happened till about 5. And I'm not saying whether I love them or not. I mean, you know, I love, you know, but you know, I actually do. But but what I'm saying is that these people that we look at as these, you know, the people that have changed our lives, that have some of the greatest talents and some of the greatest records ever made, and they took time. Whereas now it's incredibly quick, isn't it? You know, but I think also
over incredibly quick. Yeah.
And equally for me, I think part of my career, that was what started to start happening when I started really, you know, when sort of Mo Wax changed and went to XL and all that stuff, you know, take over the world with a record label in 3 years is very hard.
When you lost all your artists, was that heartbreaking and crushing that you'd built this?
Oh yeah, I mean it was. But I didn't quite understand. I think, you know, because when I was at A&M, you know, when I was leaving A&M because I was going to go to Ireland, and the big thing was we had autonomy and our own offices, and you know, da da da. They wanted to get rid of all that and just get rid of all my staff, move me into Ireland, and you know, run it as a kind of, you know, little island subsidiary.
Yeah,
I didn't want to do that, you know, and I was sort of. You know, Osman, who's in the film, who I'd signed to at A&M, and my manager, Steve Fine, at the time, are very of the sort of fact, oh, don't worry, we'll get the catalogue back. It will da-da-da-da-da, you know. Shadow will, you know, will go against Ireland, and he'll, you know, stand up, and we'll get, you know, it'll all be okay. And it wasn't. And I just didn't understand. I was very young, you know. I was 24 years old, and you know, the dream, you didn't think the dream was going to end, and it really ended very quickly, you know. And then going into XL, I think, you know, the band kind of split up, really, you know, and in that way, and the sort of the machine kind of got broken, and the media changed its tone on what you were doing, and everything sort of it just didn't quite work. And every time you try and sign an artist, you know, a major label would try and do it for 5 times the amount. So I tried to sign a lot of bands to my wax at that time that I just couldn't in the end, you know. And I also was I think because of the fallout with not being able to have the artist that I had, it affected me very emotionally. And also there was this amazing new rise in club culture with clubs like Fabric opening, and you know, I was very heavily involved in that, and I think, you know, and that side of my life kind of took over a bit. And there wasn't sort of, you know, my manager partner at the time had kind of was focusing on other things that he was doing and wasn't focusing on my label. And I think so the headmaster kind of left the building. And so it kind of became a kind of, you know, there was the focus left, and you know, it was over very quickly. And I unfortunately, you know, that was I walked out of Mo Wax and I put it to bed, which that's something I regret, because I sort of wish that I'd been sort of given some time to realise what was happening and what I was going, you know, what I was doing, but equally, you know. I was pretty, I was pretty, maybe quite uncontrollable character, I don't know, you know. And, you know, it was a strange, very strange and difficult period. And I think that I think that loss, that feeling of loss when, you know, to be able to grieve, I never got the time to grieve. And that basically created a snowball of where I have ended up today. And some of that's very positive and some of that hasn't been, you know. I mean, it's funny with Excel because whilst again, when you see in the film, it talks about this huge loss. The irony is that the two people that I hired to MoWax in the end, of who were working with me on MoWax, one of Nick, who worked there, signed Adele. So, you know, my influence, you know, has very much shaped, you know, and financially benefited those who invested in me, and MIA and Dizzy Rascal. So those things kind of shaped the way that, you know, a lot of how that record label became. And also in many ways, I think XL became, once MoWax was out of their way, XL sort of took on that idea and sort of, you know, became what, you know, maybe MoWax could never have been that, because would have I have signed Adele, or would I have made the record they've made? Because MoWax was very much its brilliance is also what kills it, because it becomes this very close, you know, it's very open-minded and then suddenly becomes kind of close-minded, because everybody wants to, it becomes a community and a kind of, you know, a gang type thing. And to break out of those things and be like, can't be commercial, don't do that, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like,
absolutely.
It's hard, you know,
there's a window, isn't there, of just perfection, where all ingredients and elements are just exactly right,
every great label was like that,
yeah,
and it's whether they break out of that or not.
Yeah,
well, Factory didn't survive, you know. Would Factory have then gone and signed, you know, a pop act to survive? London Records could, you know, but, you know, all, you know, you look at Virgin, you look at Island, you look at, you know Atlantic, they all started out as very culturally sort of
purist
yeah. labels. And then there comes a point where maybe they have, you know, Tubular Bells, or, you know, I don't know, as an example, the Island mate Bob Marley, I suppose, even though, you know, he's still kind of the ultimate hardcore artist in many ways. But it goes stratospheric. And then, you know, then the next minute, you know, Virgin is the Spice Girls and da-da-da-da-da. And I think MoWax, with its identity, that was part of its problem. In many ways, why... it's sort of I've sort of left it in many ways a sleeping dog's lie, because it's sort of a cult. It's sort of a bit like a band, and it's sort of you try and replace the lead singer when they've gone or whatever. It's really difficult. It doesn't kind of seem the same. And I don't know what would have happened if I would have gone down more of a, you know, MoWax would have, if it had grown, probably it would have had to expand it in a much broader way, I think. And whether or not I would have done that or not. Probably not at the time. I was pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
You know.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's amazing in the documentary, one of the things that the film points out is that nowadays, everybody has a clothing collaboration, their own make of sneaker. But back then, that wasn't done by anyone before you, right?
Not really in the music business.
No. To have started that legacy, if you want to call it that as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's interesting, because it sort of touches on that in the film. It doesn't really go, I think, sort of DJing and that side of things, it doesn't really go into in great detail. But I think that... Science fiction is the blueprint to most modern, you know, especially urban records. The Kanye's, the Pharrell's, pretty much every major hip hop artist right now. Well, actually, Billie Eilish has got now a t-shirt coming out with Murakami. You know, it's like, it's not to say that those things haven't happened before, but there'll be, like you say, I mean, in pop especially, and hip hop and urban, it's a pretty major landscape for how records are released, and especially people like Kanye, there is the and in many ways, actually the records sell the merchandise line.
Yeah.
Back in the day, the merchandise was just a nice bonus, but the records, you made money out of your records, And I think now, the idea of a whole 360 thing, same way with, DJing, all these things. I mean, I think that egotistically, I was right there at the forefront of all those things, I think. But it was thought out in the sense that I wanted to do these things and join these dots. But it was incredibly difficult. And it was, when I started doing toys with science fiction and stuff like that, got absolutely slated in the music press,
What, because it was seen as corny or something?
Well, it was just seen that it wasn't about music. It was all about all this other stuff, to me, it was just all culturally went hand in hand. But I think that was coming up from a tribal way of growing up with music. And I think it makes me laugh that people sort of say that image, back in the day when you'd read an article and people would say, oh, it's all about the image. I'm like, but it's always been about the image, whether it's from rock and roll to blues to hip hop to soul. There's a soul boy image. There's a hip hop image. There's a rockabilly image. And, there's a goth image. That's what was in,
like,
what,
the full
that
package.
Was great. Yeah, the full package. And so the idea to create those things within, coming from the world that I did seemed kind of logical to me. But I think I was very much there at the beginning, but I think also there's a sort of build and destroy mentality that I grew up with, where you kind of get to a certain point, you move on. You don't want to keep repeating yourself. And so for me, there was a point with streetwear and all of that sort of stuff where I moved away from it at a time when it really exploded, and I've had a habit of doing that, unfortunately, that I seem to have left the building right at the moment that things have happened. But then maybe that's allowed my career to grow up to be what it is in many ways. I don't know, if I'd financially benefited out of things, maybe I wouldn't. I'd have a, what would my life would be now? I don't know. Would I be one of those fucking, wanky record execs? Maybe. I don't know. Would I just be I don't know. There's a lot of that stuff that I don't, where people have become, I don't like, and so I don't know, but it's funny. It's weird to sort of sometimes I sort of look around, sort of see one's life flash in front of my eyes in so many different circumstances, in sort of what's happening with a lot of contemporary culture, from what we would do, myself and people that are around me were doing at the time,
Well, you must feel very liberated and free as a creative person, because there's not many people who can list the last, collaborators that you have on your vast back catalogue, from Eno to Badly Drawn Boy to Josh Homme to, I mean, it's crazy. And the dots, I couldn't see anybody else joining.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's lots of people that have done amazing collaborations. There's lots of...
Even on that first record on Science Fiction, you've got what? Mike D, Badly Drawn Boy. Who else is on that one?
Mike D, Badly Drawn Boy, Atlantic.
Ian Brown.
No, well, Ian's on... He's not. He was on the single after. Tom York, Richard Ashcroft, Will Malone, Cool G Rap, Jason Newsted, Mark Hollis, and probably some others in there as well. Yeah.
It's pretty insane, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty insane. But there's there's so many more that I'd like to work with.
The list is still...
Yeah, of course. Unfortunately, there's a few that are not with us anymore, but there's a lot of young, great... I mean, there's just constant thing of really great new artists coming out constantly, and people that have, that have inspired you, that you want to. So there's quite a breadth of generations of people that one would like.
Well, I've noticed that actually, is you've got the kind of legends, and then you've got the people who are sort of, I guess, like synonymous with a certain scene and time. And then you've also got, as you say, these upcoming, fresh, exciting new artists as well. And it all sort of works together as one.
I hope so. Sometimes.
Sometimes. What's the Kubrick connection?
Kubrick connection is that I did an exhibition. I was a huge fan of Kubrick as a kid growing up. I managed to get his details when I recorded Lonely Soul, and I wrote to him to try and get him to do a video for Lonely Soul, in which his assistant told me that it was very interesting. Why don't you give him a shout back in 6 months after he's wrapped this film called Eyes Wide Shut? He passed, so that never happened. And I'm sure it would never have happened in the first place, but it was quite an interesting story. And fast forward a couple of decades, and I was asked by a mutual friend of mine, because I was putting on these daydreaming exhibitions where I was having sort of art and music collaboration going on. I was asked by a curator friend of mine. She was like, look, my friend runs the Stanley Kubrick estate for Warners and would really love to talk to you about it. They want to open the doors. And they want some people, somebody to come in and help them sort of look at what they could do with, contemporizing things and da 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 da.
Is this like a first?
Huh?
Is this like a first? Like they've been under lock and key for X amount of years and now they're ready to share.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I went in and I was asked, I met Con, who was running the estate at the time for Warners. And I just put on a daydreaming show, I think in Hong Kong. And I did the show at Haunch of Venison in London. And I was originally sort of asked if I wanted to do some kind of Stanley Kubrick-based live performance. And I sort of said, not really. I thought it was a bit, they were already doing the sort of 2001 classical performance and stuff like that. And I felt it was a bit, wasn't really what I wanted to do. But what I really would love to do is what I've been doing with daydreaming, where I'd get different artists from different, worlds, whether it be, from music to painting to sculpture to film, yada, 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 and put on a show based on these people interpreting his work. And I'd do it if I had the blessing of his family. And so I put together a proposal, and Christiana loved it, who is his wife, who is an artist. And I worked on it for 5 years, and eventually it happened at Somerset House, and it was about 60 or 70 artists involved, from totally across the board, from example Anish Kapoor to Mick Jones to where the track Kubrick on the new record comes from, to Thomas from Daft Punk, to Mark Quinn, to Matt Collishaw, to Joseph Kasuth, to Gavin Turk, to Sarah Lucas, to the Wilson sisters. I mean, it was a pretty extraordinary experience. I mean, there's so many people involved, And it was sort of one of my creative highlights, really, and also to sort of have a little bit of access to their world. And I spent time with Christiana and interviewed her and spent time at the house, and I ended up recording a lot of stuff at their house, music and stuff. It was, and to be then told by Christiana once she saw the show, because once I... all she said to me is like, please stay away from the whole kind of conspiracy shit, because it's absolute bullshit. And it's like, please just try and leave that alone. And two, really don't try and over intellectualize everything. Like, I'm so over intellectualized by the Kubrick world, and just be free and do something which is different and sort of break the mold and engage with youth culture, and which was a great remit, because that's what I wanted to do,
And you're exactly the right person for the job. And thank God somebody has gone into that world and done that, because as a huge fan of his work, he was such a cutting edge, exciting, amazing filmmaker. And it's been so stuffy, intellectualized.
And she was just like, I'm bored of that. She was like, I've just been to LA and, we did some big thing in LA, and people like touching me and crying and da da da. And she's like, God damn it, it's like making films, that's just, it's about, making stuff, And so it was weird, because the opening of the show, she came with Jan, her brother, who is his producer, who is also very supportive of the show. And I had this moment, I just thought, fuck, what if she doesn't like it? You know, because I sort of ended up, what, you know, I was working with his legacy, but I had, that she sort of became the person that I wanted to sort of give this back, because she was an artist, she's an artist, you know. And from talking to her, I realized, you know, so much, she had so much involvement in a lot of the art side of what went into the process. So she was there mixing paint in the sink with Douglas Trumbull, or you know, putting paintings up in all the houses for the scenes in Eyes Wide Shut, or, you know, as examples, or, you know, so there were her, you know, she had this, you know, there was a very involved process with her husband of you know, certain elements of design within the film. So I really wanted, she suddenly became the muse for me of what the show, I wanted to give back and be this sort of, I wanted her to feel that I've celebrated their work, not just his, you know. And it was one of the most rewarding things for me ever when she was asked what she thought he would have thought about it for a documentary. And she said she just thought it was amazing. It was the best exhibition she's ever seen of his work outside of what he'd, you know, of really, you know, what he'd created. But in the sense of, she just said that he would have absolutely loved it, because it was about, you know, moving things into a different place, moving forward. And that was what he was into, you know. So that was pretty, pretty dope.
Yeah, what a great honour. And yeah, what a great reward. And that's kind of why you do it, right? Is for moments like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, oh, 100%.
It's not about
yeah,
the album sales.
No, or... no. Unfortunately. Although, sometimes yeah, not. Yeah.
Although they are nice.
They are nice.
Talk yeah, to me about Meltdown Festival, James. How did you yeah, get that offer, first of all?
Well, I'd been... sort of, it was weird. I'd been asked...
That's kind of the climactic scene, really, isn't it?
Yeah, in the
documentary.
Film, yeah,
and it does
yeah,
feel like that's yeah, the point in the story when everything...
Oh,
it's kind
the
of
comeback.
Yeah,
moments,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
But like where old, not scores, but where old bridges are rebuilt.
Yeah, yeah. I think definitely.
And was that
amplified
the case
in the film?
Yeah, right.
You know?
So it was. Oh, definitely,
I'd seen Shadow many times before Meltdown. You know, many, many times. As an example, but it works well in a movie. I
yes,
suppose. It was interesting. I had been putting on these exhibitions. Split up, the band had split up in a pretty not great way. Gavin was not very, you know, was very unwell. It all become very difficult, and the business partner that I'd been involved with had, I kind of got really shafted again, you know, and so I was in a pretty strange place, and that sort of place of sort of thinking, what am I going to do next, and where am I going now, you know, is that sort of, you, I think as artists sometimes you have these moments of like, is that it, have I done what I'm meant to do now, and that's, you know, and I'm, you know, I mean, I've still got so much more to say, but maybe that's, you know, and
at least it's been a good ride.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I'd been asked, we'd been doing, you know, as Uncle Live, we'd been doing these sort of, we were actually one of the first, it was us and Massive Attack were the first people to do the Heretic Orchestra shows. So the Heretics Orchestra first did, one of the main shows was doing Blade Runner with Massive Attack at their Meltdown. And then us, we did a classical versions of our, so, because we have so many string elements to our songs, we ended up doing these sort of classical shows. We'd been asked to do one of the, they had a kind of classical electronic festival at Meltdown, and we'd asked me to do it a couple of times. I think Eno was doing it. You know, this was probably about 5 years before Meltdown. And this conversation had been going back and forth a bit. And then Jane, who ran contemporary music curator at the South Bank, basically, you know, had got in touch about, you know, she's seen daydreaming stuff and we, you know, and what I was doing with music and da 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 da, and thought, you know, we started having this conversation about, why don't we do a weekend, you know, program a weekend, you know, we can do a sort of daydreaming show, we can do a classical uncle show, you know, you can curate it a bit, you know, a mini Meltdown, you know, kind of vibe. And so we were talking about that, and, you know, I came up with a lot of ideas and stuff, and it's all very positive and da da da, and it's sort of going back and forth. And then I was asked to come over and meet Jude Kelly, who ran the South Bank at the time, and Jane, because they wanted to talk to me. So I went with my new manager, and you know, went in and sort of thinking that they were going to maybe do this weekend, or, you know, da da da. And they sat me down and said, look, you know, rather than the weekend sort of doing this mini meltdown, we'd like to do a meltdown. And it was like, would you do it? It was a sort of jaw dropping moment for me.
I'll bet, man.
And I think the planets aligned at the right time. I think that they'd been frustrated some of the shows over the last few years, I think they felt that maybe the curators hadn't invested enough time. They weren't present. And a lot of it had been American. And so I don't mean it in any negative way, but I think they wanted, it was the 21 year anniversary of My Wax. It was the 21 year anniversary of Meltdown. They wanted to do something special. And they wanted to do something which felt that it engaged very much with much more London-based community. It wasn't. It kind of felt like it wanted to be a real London happening. Not that Meltdown isn't, but I think that just in the sense of, I think they just knew that I was going to work my fucking ass off and give it everything and be present, there. You know, and I was there for 6 months working on Meltdown, and you know, it was a huge learning curve, and it was incredibly emotional and lots of highs and lots of lows. There were a lot of people that I'd hoped that were going to play. You know, it's funny because they always tell you, like, you'll do your first wish list. Don't get too down because you'll probably only get a couple of them. You know, you won't find it as easy as you think. So you're like, okay, whatever. Okay, so write a letter to Robert Plant, Depeche Mode, blah, blah, you know, Massive Attack, whatever, you know. And slowly you start seeing that things just, you know, and then other people that are really enthusiastic and da da, and it just becomes this huge, giant puzzle. But my whole thing with it was I was like, I want to push every fucking part of this building that we can use to the limits that we can within the budget we have. So, you know, I think it's probably the only time now that that really happened, because we had the Spiegel tent outside with DJ Harvey. The first time there was a DJ, paid DJ event where people were going to more like a club. We had a club inside the foyer. We had a MOAX exhibition in there. We had an installation with Doug Foster. We had, you know, we had in the car park in the bottom, we had, you know, an event, you know, with that was with Wolf Tone when they just started Paul Epworth's label and Glass Animals. And, you know, there was something going on everywhere in the venue. There were nightclubs. We did a night, we did a club night outside of the venue with me and DJ Shadow in Vauxhall. You know, and it was literally like the whole place just became this sort of alive. You know, we had the Sunday come down session where it was like, you know, all day on the last day and on the Sunday, it was, you know, Jerry Deller's Acid Brass Band, Don Letts, me, Secret Sundays, Heat Horse Meat Disco, you know, playing, you know, from soul and reggae and hip hop through to, at the end, Acid House. I mean, the last record I played, I think, was Higher State of Consciousness, you know, and it was one of the most amazing moments where, you know, I got a text from my friend just saying, look, man, I'm with my kids, we're looking at you, you're playing Higher State of Consciousness, and right behind you is the Houses of Parliament. You know, we've won, like, you know, we've taken over, you know.
That's a great
I had right artists there. I had, you know, from people, you know, we had workshops, you know, from teaching kids how to use Ableton Live through to, you know, talks with from Gavin Turk through to, you know, myself and Giles Peterson. It was really an amazing, amazing experience and a real coming together. I think that for me, I never felt in the same way that really most of the previous curators are seen as musicians, essentially, you know, David Bowie or Nick Cave, or, you know, as examples, you know, I didn't feel that I was that to people. But what I did feel that I could do is just not make it so much about me, but this cultural legacy that one had been part of and the influences of that legacy, and also the contemporary elements, and bringing that all together, you know, and I think that was what was special about that. It just felt like for a certain group of people, and there's a lot of those people in London, that was the moment where all of that stuff was celebrated, you know. And so it was, you know, it doesn't get much better than that, you know. And also it's amazing to be able to to go, you know, rather than having to go to a festival or touring around to, for, you know, every day go to the Royal Festival Hall to the South Bank and that be your home, you know. And at that time they had the installation on the roof of the Hayward, which was the boat, which was like a hotel room. And I, you know, staying in there, and that was, you know, the best, probably the best view you could ever imagine of London, you know. Just all those things, and being there with, you know, all these people that I'd, you know, grown up with, hadn't, a lot of people obviously hadn't seen, which is very cathartic when we did the MOAX launch of the book, and you know, and doing the Uncle Show, which really became the sort of the conduit to me then wanting to make records again, because I think that I'd felt pretty pre-meltdown. I felt pretty down and pretty like, I don't know. I just felt that people probably didn't, I didn't know who wanted to work with me anymore. I felt pretty a bit lost, you know? And then suddenly you've got 80 people on stage doing an Uncle Show with all these people that you've, you know, from Esker and Rosie Lowe and Keaton Henson to the LCO to, you know, to Mark Lanegan. It was like, there was just love. There was a lot of love, and it felt like, okay, well, that's great. So maybe it's time to start making another record and take that energy from what I've experienced here into moving forward, you know.
And that was the birth of The Road, was it?
That was the birth of The Road, yeah.
And that's now going to be a trilogy, I hear.
Always going to be a trilogy.
Always, yeah. That was always the idea, right? So obviously part one's been out for a while, people are familiar with
that.
Yeah,
if you imagine it, so part one, I hadn't made a record for 7 years. I wanted to make something that just felt concise, that felt like it had all the elements of what I like about Uncle, but didn't kind of be, it wasn't, you know,
a throwback.
Yeah, but also, you know, no record had been less than 74 minutes, you know, and you know, a lot of sort of seen as very, you know, a lot, maybe to a lot of people kind of overly epic or whatever, you know. I wanted to make just something that felt concise, that felt like as a comeback record, it was I think 48 minutes, just felt like, okay, this is, and you know, let's start here. And also, I felt that in this idea of a trilogy, the first record would be, it's sort of a slightly, going back to being a bit naive, it's sort of like leaving home. You know, in my head, I was thinking, you know, I wanted to do a kind of Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. I wanted to do my sort of odyssey, my home, you know, that was, you know, my feeling maybe is this lone, because I was on my own, this sort of Odysseus, being on my own and trying to get the fuck home, and where is home, and all of those experiences, because...
Well, you've certainly got the life experience to pull from.
Yeah, and I felt, so the first record was sort of like walking out the door and that sort of, you know, okay, here we go. You know,
wide-eyed excitement.
Yeah, and then you get to the second record, which we've had, which is coming out now, tomorrow, which is more a sort of that journey of experimenting and trying things out and, get, you know, love and light and dark and all that sort of stuff. And
do you go through a lot of the highs and the lows again whilst making it? And was it a ride, just the recording process?
Yeah.
Was it draining on you?
It has been draining, yeah, because I have had, there has been some family issues that I've had to deal with in the last year, which has been very difficult. And so that combined, you know, making part one was kind of pretty...
Bit of a DOS.
Not a DOS, but it was a very joyful experience. And it was like, wow, this is great. Making records is kind of, doesn't have to be so fucking painful. Putting together this part two has been kind of a bit difficult, to be perfectly honest with you, because and I don't want to go into detail because of what's been happening, unfortunately, with my family. And so it's been kind of difficult to, you know, mentally engage at times. And I also, I took quite a bite on where it's a double record and, you know, and you are, I'm a self sort of producing, funding artist, and sort of trying to put all of the elements together this time has been kind of a little bit, it's been a bit difficult.
Did you think?
But it's also because I've done a lot of other stuff. I've done 7 projects in the last 2 years. So I've done The Road Part One. I've had a live record. I've had Trust. I've had The Man from MOAX film. I've had now this double album, and I've done another couple of TV shows. So I've done about 7 albums in the last 2 years. So I think equally, you know, there's been a lot going on. And I think that, I'm sort of looking forward to get past this get, you know, also part of it is I desperately want to, I kind of need to move on.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of this, you know, the road starts pretty much just after Meltdown, and we're at this point now. And so a lot of the material on this record is some of it's from way back at the beginning, and some of it's really new in the sense of when the initial, the initializing of a track would come from, you know. So, you know, first time Touch Me go way back, something like Armor was started, you know, literally a couple of weeks, you know, a few weeks before I finished the record. So, you know, and I, you know, you're sort of trying to put everything together and, you know, and get it, you know, try hopefully to find some cohesion. That's why, because it was very eclectic, the material, I wanted to, I sort of, in my head, I visualized it more as more of a kind of radio show, more of a time lapse, more of a sort of mixtape, that it would, you know, that it's sort of, you're on a journey and, you know, if this is this middle period of life's journey, it's quite, life can be quite erratic and take you to all these different places. But equally, you know, I have a radio show that I've been doing the last year, which is really,
I was going to ask whether that had kind of fed
into
it. Yeah,
because it sort of takes you out of the club mentality. With the club mentality,
I much prefer DJing to a music fan rather than a dance floor.
Yeah, I mean, I like both. But if you're playing to a dance floor,
you got
to
keep
you
got
to keep it going. And great DJs are people that can navigate between what I call education and entertainment. So you break a record that nobody's ever heard, and they think they know it, because they keep going, and you play something that people like. And that's, I think that's...
Yeah, it's like the old film trailer.
But you are playing, you are essentially, unless you want, you know, there are people that do enjoy pissing people off when they play. I generally like, I like the crowd to go wild, and yeah. I want that energy, and especially playing predominantly more dance music orientated things. Playing on the radio just allows you to be really free. And it's a different feeling, and it's a different mentality, and it's a different way of communicating. And it's been brilliant. And so for me to be able to apply that into the record, I thought was important, you know, that mentality. And so, and I also didn't want to make this as a statement that it's like, it is an eclectic record. That's okay. Let me make an eclectic record and just look at it in a different way. It's not, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not, it is cohesive by the nature of the emotion. And I think sonically, there is a certain emotion that threads things, but it's, you know, it's more of a playlist. It's not, you know, it's not being made in the way that I would have made science fiction or war stories, you know, as an example. And I think now to me, the third part has always been about coming home.
Wherever that is, right?
Well, Freudian way, I'm coming home because I've sort of everything I've had to come back. You know, I've spent long times getting away and moving on. You know, in the sense that, you know, most of the albums that I've made were kind of different in the places they were recorded and the environment and the people that was within them. So you look at a record from science fiction to war stories, it's quite a different environment and sonic. I think emotionally very similar. But in the sense that I'd kind of gone out on quite extreme places, you know, I put myself in lots of different environments, and I think, you know, it's, you do that, and then you suddenly start, you know, sometimes you can get lost, and you can kind of, you're out there on your own, you know, and you want to, you need to start kind of coming back to the things that make you happy, or the things that you, the building blocks of why, you know. I think it's quite, I think it's part of age, you know, and experience. And I, you know, there are things that I never got to do in the beginning that I wanted to do. You know, science fiction became this record, but it became what it became. But initially, it was going to be a much more soul based. It was much more in tune with what I was trying to do to Massive Attack or Soul to Soul or something like that, or Young Disciples, than it was. But it just, these things just take a life, you know, and the life ended up being that you're working with Tom York and Rich Apple, which was incredible. But I think that it would have been, you know, it would have been a different record, you know, in the way that it was considered. And when I put out my director's cut later this year, you'll hear tracks that I did with Tim before Shadow, which are more in that world. And this has got nothing to do with anything about what I'm not criticizing or amplifying the record. It's just the process of what happens. For me, you know, there are, you know, like recently, I did a track for an inspired by score for Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, and I did a track with Michael Kinanuka. And, you know, where I've gone with that is, like, I've always wanted to make a song like that. you know, I came from predominantly black music, and through, you know, I've ended up, then I ended up having the biggest success I ever did with Queens of the Stone Age, you know, which is just quite a, you know, I think, you know, for most people's careers, it's quite a, you know, it's quite a sort of, it's quite extreme, you know, the connections are very much emotionally, there's huge sonic connections, and I can draw in all these dots, I can put together why, you know, Josh and, you know, why to me, Josh is no much, it's not that much dissimilar to Massive Attack or whatever, but that's my, that's how my brain sort of works. But for most people, it's like, that's hard rock, and that's...
That's what I was saying, you know, earlier, there's so few people that could join those dots.
Yeah. But I also now, I'm sort of going back to where I came, you know, I'm sort of trying to just go, there's a bit of going back, like, you're sitting in my house now, I live in, you know, a leafy part of West London, which is very akin to where I grew up. I spent the last 20 years going as far away in the sense of visually, aesthetically from where I grew up as possible. So, you know, we're getting into a whole Freudian thing, but, you know, but for me, the third record is really about coming home, and that will be about, you know, in my head about, there's a record that I've wanted to make for a very long time that I haven't. And that goes right back to the beginning. So that's where, but it may not, who knows, but that's what is in my head.
Do you feel like that's going to be the sort of culmination of everything that's happened so far? Yes. Musically and personally?
Yes. Yeah.
And then, of course, I guess the big question then is, what's next after that?
Indeed. Well, you know,
a break or?
Yeah. I don't know. I like making stuff, and I, you know, but I, yeah, I would, I sort of want to, yeah, I can think that far at the moment. Above that, I don't know yet. I sort of do, but I don't. We'll see.
When do you start for it, or have you started recording?
I've started bits, but I'm also like, I'm a bit burnt at the moment. I've done a lot, and I'm trying to live with what I've just done as well and take that all in. And, you know, there is a constant thing with me that it's just constantly move, da, 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 da. And you see that in the film, and it's sort of happening a bit again at the moment, and I just want to slow down a little bit if I can. But I also would like, I'd really like to tour more at the moment, to be honest with you. That's what I'd really like to do, is just have a bit of time just traveling and playing.
That's where the songs live, isn't
it? You know, I want to live with the songs, because it's been so much about this work, this new da, 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 and then actually you're just not getting to live with it, and I'd just like to be able to live with it for a while. Because I also, you know, whilst I have an idea of what this record, I want this record to be, I think I need a bit of time to develop those ideas, you know. So we'll see.
James, what a pleasure, man. I could talk to you all day.
Thank you.
We'll have to do a part two when Definitely. Three comes out.
Excellent. Thank you.
Because I'm good pals with Davey Catching, and I've been to the Rancho, and I'd love to get into that world with you and hear about your experiences there. But I think we'll close it here for now.
Brilliant.
Thanks for having me over, and thanks for being such a great guest, dude.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Nice one.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.